So, good evening. Tonight we pick up chapter 17 in The Life Divine, The Divine Soul. Of course, in recent chapters, we've been watching Sri Aurobindo develop a picture of the great chain of being as it descends from its inalienable unity in Satchit Ananda, as an expression, a positive expression of that unknowable vastness which lies beyond, which we could only figure as non-being, because it escapes even the very definition of what it means to be. So great is it, so free is it. But as this inalienable unity of Satchitananda, through its power of consciousness force, leans towards expressing some ordered picture of its own nature, it forms a supramental consciousness which, in emerging from this unitive state, takes a triply stationed poise. They are not divided. We should not think of them as having fences between them. But in its first utterance, it says, I am vast, I am all comprehending. And then all potentiality, all multiplicity lies within that unity, but held back, unexpressed. But in the second poise of the supramental creative consciousness of the divine, there is a stationing of that immense knowledge behind, and looking out as if to apprehend itself in other forms, and we begin to see the diversity of the oneness come into being without abrogating the oneness. Unity and diversity are in perfect balance, all comes from the oneness, knows itself to be part of that one, and yet that same one, playing with its subjective power of self-concentration, can, in a way, stand back and look into the perfect truth of every form that rises from its being. The tertiary poise, the third poise of the supramental, is when, in a sense, this vast consciousness determines to project itself into those forms, as if to dwell there, and yet does so without losing its sense of unity, without losing its oneness, so that while there is a stress on the diversity, it's always within the play of the one, which is all-containing. So in the first poise, we could say comprehensive unity. In the second poise, a balance, a harmony between unity and diversity. In the third poise, unity behind, diversity to the front. And so now, if this is the nature of the supramental consciousness, what then of this individuality, which is drawn from the great, the soul individual, S-O-L-E? How is the S-O-U-L drawn from the S-O-L-E? The soul drawn from the soul. So Sri Aurobindo, publishing this, The Divine Soul, on the 15th of December in 1915, opens with one of his favorite Upanishads, the one on which he wrote that whole monograph, which he originally called The Life Divine, Set It Aside. The Isha, the Upanishad of the Lord. And he has chosen for the motto for this chapter the seventh verse, which reads in English, as he translates it here, he whose self has become all existences, for he has the knowledge, how shall he be deluded? Whence shall he have grief? He who sees everywhere oneness. So clearly, this mystic aphorism captured in the Isha Upanishad is an expression of a profound experience and realization. Experience, because even to see it is a great thing. To see this harmony, to see this oneness, bringing all things into its ken, abolishes all sense of grief. But to see that oneness permanently is the connotation here, because how shall he have grief who sees everywhere oneness, not for a moment, but who just sees it? He has been seized by that oneness. It's ekatvam, is that oneness in Sanskrit. Now, Sri Aurobindo, in drawing upon this Upanishad, is reintroducing us to a verse that he translated and published in the very first issue of the Arya. So this appeared on the 15th of August in 1914, but here he has slightly differed in the translation. He has gone back and edited it and said, I think I can do something a little more clear. In the first issue of the Arya, in the translation of the Isha Upanishad, he rendered it in English, he in whom it is the self-being that has become all existences that are becomings, for he has the perfect knowledge. How shall he be deluded? Whence shall he have grief? He who sees everywhere oneness. Well, this is a more compact and I think equally fine rendering of the Sanskrit. And the Isha Upanishad, as you would probably remember from our study of it long back, you know, is the closing section of the Shukla Yajur Veda Samhita, and is considered to be a mantra Upanishad because it is in mantric form, it is in verse, it has a meter. And it being the only Upanishad, which is actually in the body of a Vedic collection, it is also called a Samhita Upanishad. So, if you look at that verse, he whose self has become all existences. So there's one being. Seen subjectively, we can call it a self, who has established itself as all that moves. Yet, they do not dwell outside him. They are within the scope of his singular being. The Upanishad is called the Isha, so all are referenced back to this initiating lordship who wills to become many, multiplies himself, but contains all. And if you rise to the knowledge, out of division, out of partiality, and see the whole picture, then all grief is abolished, all delusion is abolished, and you have the experience that the divine itself experiences, the thrill of the creation, the thrill of the maintenance, the fundamental bliss that underlies all, the partnership, the sameness, that are the warp and the woof of all this play. So now, let me get my words out of the way. Let's go to the words of the Master. Let's go to Sri Aurobindo. And he writes, by the conception we have formed of the supermind, by its opposition to the mentality on which our human existence is based, we are able not only to form a precise instead of a vague idea of divinity and the divine life, expressions which we are otherwise condemned to use with looseness and as the vague wording of a large but almost impalpable aspiration, but also to give these ideas a firm basis of philosophical reasoning, to put them into a clear relation with the humanity and the human life, which is all we at present enjoy, and to justify our hope and aspiration by the very nature of the world and of our own cosmic antecedents and the inevitable future of our evolution. So this is a very positive view. He has here compared and contrasted supermind and mind in order to develop a philosophic idea of what the divine nature is. When he says that we don't want to subject ourselves or be condemned to a vague wording or an impalpable aspiration, impalpable, if you haven't met that word before, simply means incapable of being touched or incapable of being perceived by the senses or by the mind. So in other words, we have this notion of what it is we're talking about, but we can't quite say what it is. So to try to give a firm definition to some of these ideas, the triple status of the supermind, for instance, is an effort to render into philosophic language, that is, the clear language of mental reason, what would serve as a simulacrum of what that is. In other words, we know this is just a model, but it's a model that makes sense to the mind. And all of this is set within the perspective that the human gains of its life in general, not just an individual, but of human life as a whole, set within the framework of a growing consciousness expressed in terms of evolution, within the larger context of a cosmos, which has a fundamental ordering law to it, born from that divine creative consciousness of the supermind. So there's a positive basis of everything, and a place that we're developing ourselves to go to. We are retooling ourselves as we move along so that we can rediscover our own divine nature and our place in the whole, and find at the end of a long personal and cosmic journey that, we're back to that source, to that oneness. We never really could leave it, but to rediscover it and enjoy it all afresh is the delight of the play. So Sri Aurobindo then writes, "We begin to grasp intellectually what is the divine, the eternal reality, and to understand how out of it the world has come. We also begin to perceive how inevitably that which has come out of the divine must return to the divine. We may now ask with profit and a chance of clearer reply how we must change and what we must become in order to arrive there in our nature and our life and our relations with others, and not only through a solitary and ecstatic realization in the profundities of our being." It is not enough for Sri Aurobindo for us to have an exalted mystic immersion into that absolute reality, into that oneness, the drop disappearing into the ocean, but we must bring the richness of what that is into all that we experience here, into self, into our relations with all, into the very world itself. Only that justifies it. So what he's saying here is that while we frame this in philosophic theory, there is a practical result towards which we aim, to change ourselves. How we must change and what we must become. That's the whole prospect. We don't want to simply know as an academic exercise, as an interior experience. We want to know how to do it. We're going to give this a yogic framework. This must become our experience, not only of the better parts of our nature, quote, but of all of our nature. Certainly, he writes, there is still a defect in our premises, for we have so far been striving to define for ourselves what the divine is in its descent towards limited nature, whereas what we ourselves actually are is the divine in the individual ascending back out of limited nature to its own proper divinity. Well, his apology, we accept. But he's right on target in describing how in the great chain of being, things emerge from the one and come down towards the diverse. But we have to remember from our own personal experience that to discover the divine within and to work back upwards is our direction of ascent. That's the practical purpose before us. So, he writes, this difference of movement must involve a difference between the life of the gods who have never known the fall and the life of man redeemed, conqueror of the lost Godhead, and bearing within him the experience, and it may be the new riches gathered by him from his acceptance of the utter descent. Nevertheless, there can be no difference of essential characteristics, but only of mold and coloring. We can already ascertain on the basis of the conclusions at which we have arrived the essential nature of the divine life towards which we aspire. So our ascent to the recovery of divinity, and viewed from either side of that transversal line separating that higher hemisphere of the supramental reality from what we experience in divided nature here, the essence is the same. Always, there can be no difference, as he says, of essential characteristics, only of mold and coloring, because there is only one existence. There is no second. Back to the Chandogya Upanishad. And so onward. Wonderful paragraph, right? What then would be the existence of a divine soul not descended into the ignorance by the fall of spirit into matter and the eclipse of soul by material nature? So now he will give us a description. What would be its consciousness? Living in the original truth of things, in the inalienable unity, in the world of its own infinite being, like the divine existence itself, but able by the play of the divine Maya and by the distinction of the comprehending and apprehending truth consciousness, to enjoy also difference from God at the same time as unity with him, and to embrace difference and yet oneness with other divine souls in the infinite play of the self-multiplied identical. So he has put a whole philosophy into a sentence. So the divine soul that he describes here is that individual soul, the truth of your existence. He is not describing simply the Lord, but the Lord imparted to all beings, dwelling secretly inside all beings, as he says, like the divine existence itself, but able by the play to enjoy also difference from God and unity with him. So that same divine reality dwells within each of us that he will now describe in some detail in terms of its rounded characteristics. But it's always present within us. We must not forget that. We must ever push forwards or inwards to discover it in ourselves and in others. So he continues, obviously, the existence of such a soul would be always self-contained in the conscious play of Satchit-Ananda. It would be pure and infinite self-existence in its being. In its becoming, it would be a free play of immortal life, uninvaded by death and birth and change of body, because unclouded by ignorance and not involved in the darkness of our material being. It would be a pure and unlimited consciousness in its energy, poised in an eternal and luminous tranquility as its foundation, yet able to play freely with forms of knowledge and forms of conscious power, tranquil, unaffected by the stumblings of mental error and the misprisions of our striving will, because it never departs from truth and oneness, never falls from the inherent light and the natural harmony of its divine existence. It would be, finally, a pure and inalienable delight in its eternal self-experience, and in time, a free variation of bliss unaffected by our perversions of dislike, hatred, discontent, and suffering, because undivided in being, unbaffled by erring self-will, unperverted by the ignorant stimulus of desire. So this, given the opportunity to offer descriptive power to the divine soul, is what its nature looks like, positively described. It is a conscious play of Satchit-Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, deliberately put forward. It is immortal. It is infinite. It is calm, tranquil, unhurried, as it rolls out its rhythms according to the proper law of things. This is the basis of its awareness. And supporting it and waiting for it, as well as sustaining throughout all of its journey forward, all of its manifest nature, inalienable delight. Delight that cannot be taken away or transferred to another. It belongs, it is, it ever was, it ever will be. So there is a free play of the divine soul in all of its multiple forms. That means that there is no compulsion. The One has entered freely into this self-expression without dividing any from its essential oneness. And all the play, from the start of the fountain flowing out to the plashing of the waters on the foundation, is only an expression of bliss. We can experience it as bliss, even from the standpoint of the many, when we dwell in the realm of the divine soul, because there is no division, there is no lapse into ignorance, there is no separation. We rejoice in the oneness that unites us all, and we rejoice in the victories and the exaltations that the other soul across from us has in his experience of nature, which in that world is Satchidananda, distributed widely. So, to this point, he's described it, in a sense, in positive terms. For a moment, he'll say, in a sense, what it's not. Its consciousness, he writes, would not be shut out from any part of the infinite truth, nor limited by any poise or status that it might assume in its relations with others, nor condemned to any loss of self-knowledge by its acceptance of a purely phenomenal individuality and the play of practical differentiation. It would, in its self-experience, live eternally in the presence of the Absolute. To us, the Absolute is only an intellectual conception of indefinable existence. The intellect tells us simply that there is a Brahman higher than the highest, Paratpara, an unknowable that knows itself in other fashion than that of our knowledge, but the intellect cannot bring us into its presence. The divine soul, living in the truth of things, would, on the contrary, always have the conscious sense of itself as a manifestation of the Absolute. Its immutable existence, it would be aware of as the original self-form of that transcendent, Satchit-Ananda. Its play of conscious being, it would be aware of as manifestation of that in forms of Satchit-Ananda. In its every state or act of knowledge, it would be aware of the unknowable cognizing itself by a form of variable self-knowledge. In its every state or act of power, will, or force, aware of the transcendence possessing itself by a form of conscious power of being and knowledge. In its every state or act of delight, joy, or love, aware of the transcendence embracing itself by a form of conscious self-enjoyment. This presence of the Absolute would not be with it as an experience occasionally glimpsed or finally arrived at and held with difficulty, or as an addition, acquisition, or culmination superimposed on its ordinary state of being. It would be the very foundation of its being, both in the unity and the differentiation. It would be present to it in all its knowing, willing, doing, enjoying. It would be absent neither from its timeless self, nor from any moment of time, neither from its spaceless being, nor from any determination of its extended existence, neither from its unconditioned purity beyond all cause and circumstance, nor from any relation of circumstance, condition, and causality. This constant presence of the Absolute would be the basis of its infinite freedom and delight, ensure its security in the play, and provide the root and sap and essence of its divine being. So it is a reality undivided, unlimited, undimmed. It, this divine soul, would feel itself eternally as the Absolute. It would know itself to be a deliberate manifestation of the Absolute, self-formed, drawn from the reality of Satchit-Ananda. Its presence, the Absolute presence, would be constant, foundational, never segmented, never splintered. And because it is the Absolute that has entered into forms, it is forever free. The divine soul would feel the Absolute within itself, whether it is ensconced in time and space, or if it is outside all circumstance, wrapped in its own timeless, infinite, unexpressed existence. The absolute would be present, in a sense, throughout. When we read the Mandukya Upanishad, you remember that fourth state, the Turiya. The first was the expression of the manifest and visible universe. The second poise of the Divine Spirit was the conceptive consciousness as it is drawn into itself. And the third was its absorption into absolute consciousness so that there is no separation between self and object. They don't even exist. And from that state of deep knowledge comes the conceptive consciousness, manifesting as the visible moving universe. And yet, there is a fourth state, which is beyond all, beyond even that deep sleep spirit, where consciousness is all within itself. That fourth state, Turiya, is such as is described here by Sri Aurobindo as the absolute. Beyond all definition, free even of its positive formulation as Satchidananda, expressed as the creative harmony of the supramental consciousness, ere it descends into the divided world of mind, life, and body. That is the all-comprehensive reality. So, this divine soul is always aware of that. Not through an act of discovery, but because it is its nature. It doesn't have to go out and find it again because it has never been lost. The supramental is where we find this divine soul. And this divine soul is the center of our manifest being even here. But here, in these passages, we speak of it in its own realm, in its own world, and what it is like. If we can discover it here, we have a key to existence and a key to change, much anticipated, much aspired for. So another paragraph. Moreover, such a divine soul would live simultaneously in the two terms of the eternal existence of Satchidananda, the two inseparable poles of the self-unfolding of the Absolute, which we call the One and the Many. All being does really so live, but to our divided self-awareness there is an incompatibility, a gulf between the two, driving us towards a choice to dwell either in the multiplicity, exiled from the direct and entire consciousness of the One, or in the unity, repellent of the consciousness of the Many. But the divine soul would not be enslaved to this divorce and duality. It would be aware in itself at once of the infinite self-concentration and the infinite self-extension and diffusion. It would be aware simultaneously of the One in its Unitarian consciousness, holding the innumerable multiplicity in itself as if potential, unexpressed, and therefore to our mental experience of that state, non-existent, and of the One its extended consciousness, holding the multiplicity thrown out and active as the play of its own conscious being, will, and delight. It would equally be aware of the Many, ever drawing down to themselves the One that is the eternal source and reality of their existence, and of the Many ever mounting up, attracted to the One that is the eternal culmination and blissful justification of all their play of difference. This vast view of things is the mold of the truth consciousness, the foundation of the large truth and right hymned by the Vedic seers. This unity of all these terms of opposition is the real Advaita, the supreme comprehending word of the knowledge of the unknowable. So the one and the many are equally supportive ends of a whole. The many, drawing their reality into a dispersed manifestation of the one. And always, isn't it interesting how he writes, the many ever drawing down to themselves the one that is the eternal source. So here, in a sense, we have an aspiration, a call for, as if we've sent a message to the parent divine one and said, bring me that sense of oneness here into this division. And as we call that into us, the many are ever mounting up, attracted to that, because that is the culmination. That is the end of the play of difference, arriving at the joy, the bliss, waiting reunification. And then Sri Aurobindo summons us to look at the truth consciousness, the foundation of the large truth and right hymned by the Vedic seers. Large, true, and right. Satyam, truth. Ritam, the right. Brahat, the vast. So this is the very formulation of the triple aspect of the divine. True being, which is self-ordering based upon the vastness. You can see how this folds perfectly into Sri Aurobindo's own experience and description of that supramental consciousness above. And he says, this is the real Advaita, not a philosophy that says only that is real and all else is false. The apparent movement of the universe, the apparent diversity, all are merely formations of ignorance or a fundamental illusion. Forget that, hie away to the experience of that one. Sri Aurobindo says the real Advaita swallows these opposites into an experience where the oneness is never lost in the many, and the many always know or finally or fundamentally can discover their rootedness in the one. And this is the nature of the knowledge of the unknowable. We can't know it as an object. That kind of knowledge is impossible, because the way the mind knows is to know something external to itself, to try to close division and attain a kind of makeshift communion. But to this knowledge, it penetrates truly because it is the same thing. It is all an internal act. So I think we may have time for another paragraph, if you're willing. The divine soul will be aware of all variation of being, consciousness, will, and delight as the outflowing, the extension, the diffusion of that self-concentrated unity developing itself, not into difference and division, but into another, an extended form of infinite oneness. So the divine soul is aware not only of its seatedness in the absolute, but is aware of the movement of that same absolute in all variation of being. So the whole ground of oneness is not lost as it becomes multiple, and the divine soul can view out and see that essential oneness in all things that come into manifestation. It is a oneness that predicates the many within itself. And the many can see back to the one and see that one in the all. And all, again, can see that one in each without ever losing awareness of the one at the top. He continues, it will itself always be concentrated in oneness in the essence of its being, always manifested in variation in the extension of its being. All that takes form in itself will be the manifested potentialities of the One, the Word or Name, vibrating out of the nameless silence, the form realizing the formless essence, the active will or power proceeding out of the tranquil force, the ray of self-cognition gleaming out from the sun of timeless self-awareness, the wave of becoming rising up into shape of self-conscious existence, out of the eternally self-conscious being, the joy and love welling forever out of the eternal still delight. It will be the absolute Bayun in its self-unfolding, and each relativity in it will be absolute to itself because aware of itself as the absolute manifested, but without that ignorance which excludes other relativities as alien to its being or less complete than itself. And all these are Vedic and Tantric images. These lines echo and encapsulate various schools of Vedantic philosophy and bhakti, aspiration, and devotion. Masterfully said. I think this is a good place to stop, and we'll complete the rest of the chapter next Sunday, which will be closing in on the 24th of April. We'll be within a few days of the 24th of April, that occasion when Mother returned from Japan to stand next to Sri Aurobindo and launch the integral yoga in its practicum. If you'll permit me tonight, I think a passage from Savitri in the Book of Fate would be apposite. Once in the immortal boundlessness of self, in a vast of truth and consciousness and light, the soul looked out from its felicity. It felt the spirit's interminable bliss. It knew itself deathless, timeless, spaceless, one. It saw the eternal, lived in the infinite. Then, curious of a shadow thrown by truth, it strained towards some otherness of self. It was drawn to an unknown face peering through night. It sensed a negative infinity, a void supernal, whose immense excess, imitating God and everlasting time, offered a ground for nature's adverse birth and matter's rigid, hard unconsciousness, harboring the brilliance of a transient soul that lights up birth and death and ignorant life. Some lines later. as one drawn by the grandeur of the void, the soul attracted leaned to the abyss. It longed for the adventure of ignorance, and the marvel and surprise of the unknown, and the endless possibility that lurked in the womb of chaos and in nothing's gulf, or looked from the unfathomed eyes of chance. It tired of its unchanging happiness. It turned away from immortality. It was drawn to hazard's call and danger's charm. It yearned to the pathos of grief, the drama of pain, perdition's peril, the wounded bear escape, the music of ruin and its glamour and crash, the savor of pity and the gamble of love and passion and the ambiguous face of fate. A world of hard endeavor and difficult toil, and battle on extinction's perilous verge, a clash of forces, a vast incertitude, the joy of creation out of nothingness, strange meetings on the roads of ignorance, and the companionship of half-known souls, or the solitary greatness and lonely force of a separate being conquering its world, called it from its too safe eternity. A huge descent began, a giant fall. For what the spirit sees creates a truth, and what the soul imagines is made a world. A thought that leaped from the timeless can become indicator of cosmic consequence and the itinerary of the gods, a cyclic movement in eternal time. Thus came, born from a blind, tremendous choice, this great, perplexed, and discontented world, this haunt of ignorance, this home of pain. There are pitched desire's tents, grief's headquarters. A vast disguise conceals the eternal's bliss. Ending Narad's quote. Namaste. Jai Ma.